Hello and welcome to episode 222 of Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, John Lindemann.
Regulators! Mount up.
James Jones.
Hey.
And Greg Leahy.
Hello.
Now I can put away my radio voice for the rest of the show.
Take it to the stage.
We are in the recovery period from our big live event, which many of you tuned into last weekend. And I got to say, boys, we done good.
Mm-hmm.
We did a pretty good job on that. And our listeners did a great job of participating, donating money when they could, calling in, being funny and awesome. So thank you so much. And of course, it wasn't just us. It was damn near every person on the website staff participated in some way, either on the mic or off the mic. And so I thank everybody once again for helping out with that big event. And we were really excited about how it went down. We were on the air for over 6 hours, and we raised over $2,200 for Child's Play.
Yeah, it actually kept going up after we went off the air.
It did.
Which was awesome.
Yeah. The donation link is probably dead by now, but if you did not get a chance to donate and you're still interested, we definitely encourage you to do that. You can donate to Child's Play all year round, really, at their website is childsplaycharity.org, and you should be able to find directions very easily there on what to do. But you can donate anytime. You don't have to do it through us, so really I would encourage that if you can. And, of course, if you missed the live show, I'm sorry that you did, because we had a good time, and some of that stuff was exciting because it was live, so I think the people who were actually there and able to listen to it live got the best experience, but Carl did capture a very good recording of it, and we have been posting that in three pieces, and it should all be up by the time you hear this. That's free to everybody. Download it. Check it out. If you haven't checked on iTunes recently, then there might be multiple episodes waiting for you to download. You might have to click manually to get each one. So, James, we didn't get to hear as much from you on the show. Some of your segments that you were planning for, we didn't get to before the timer ran out. And we definitely didn't get you on new business because you were busy the first hour. So I wanted to let you kick it off, man.
So I have the review of Golden Sun Dark Dawn. It's been up for about a week now. So it's probably going to be a huge surprise for what I have to say to most of our listeners, but it's Golden Sun. I mean, Golden Sun Dark Dawn is Golden Sun. The Lost Age is Golden Sun, except that the graphics are in full 3D using what is apparently the Zelda engine.
So from Phantom Hourglass and Spirit Tracks.
Yeah, even some of the menu objects seem to be carried over directly.
Well, that's a good engine.
Yeah, it looks very nice. It's a very nicely put together game. But, you know, it would have been nice to see some new elements to the game from 8 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been a long time.
So it is seriously that similar to the old games?
It's identical.
Wow.
It is identical.
That's disappointing.
I mean, there's some touchscreen controls, but it's still identical.
Yeah, every DS RPG has touchscreen controls that no one uses.
Yeah. they worked okay in a few games, but in this game, I pretty much left them alone. Did not need them.
That seems like a really missed opportunity, because Golden Sun was an okay game, the first one. I didn't play Lost Age, but it didn't seem that much different. And I felt like that was a series that really could have benefited from evolving over some time off, you know, to bring it up to a higher standard. And
see, I don't
think... It's really sad that they apparently thought the originals were so great, we'll just make another one just like
it. I loved the originals, but this game just didn't quite do it for me like they did.
Who did actually develop it?
The same people.
Camelot.
I mean, Camelot hasn't made a game in a long time, outside of, like, weird PC games. And, like, golf games or something, right?
Yeah, they made a couple golf games. They made We Love Golf, and there was one for PC, too.
Yeah.
And before that, it was, you know, all the Mario Tennis and Mario Golf stuff.
Right. So, and when I say the game is identical, I mean that, literally. I mean, it's the same game. But, I mean, there's new powers, obviously, and then the world's been changed up quite a bit due to the events of the second game, which I actually like the second game the most. In part because I felt the story was better and the characters were better.
Is there still a lot of, you know, emoticons and...
So that's still how your character talks, yeah. The awkward silences aren't quite so bad, but I think part of the reason the GBA had awkward silences was just because they wanted to make sure the bubbles didn't run into each other.
There's a lot of dot, dot, dot in Golden Sun.
That's basically what your character says. Your character, you can choose essentially emotional responses, and then, or he'll ellipses respond. Everybody else basically talks. But what's weird is that they'll react to your little emotion, but they'll only react for one block of text, and then they just go on like nothing happened. So, like, if you get irrationally angry every time, they'll act like you're irrationally angry, but then they'll just be totally cool with it afterwards. It's good fun sometimes. What's different about this game, and I said it's identical, but that's technically not true, is that in the previous two games, you couldn't miss anything. I mean, you just couldn't. So you go back and get stuff whenever you want. And that was kind of the thing. You'd beat the game, and you'd go back and get all the stuff you might have missed behind, and then you could carry it over your next game. This game doesn't carry over stuff from the previous two games, but there is stuff you can miss, which I was surprised about, and it totally caught me off guard. I ended up missing a whole swath of content. So, I'll come back for that later. So just a fair warning for anybody who's going to pick this up.
Would you consider playing it again to get that stuff that you missed?
Not right now. I mean, I've got a lot of games left to play, and I'm good with this game. What is my biggest issue with the game, though, is the story. I mean, the writing in the other two games wasn't great, but, I mean, the characters actually developed a little bit, whereas in this game, they're pretty flat. And I joke in the review, there's a character named Timmy, who they add late in the game simply because, near as I can tell, it was either give you an item to get the special Psy Energy power she has, or they just give you a character who already has it, and they can balance out with 8 characters instead of 7. That is seems to be how they decided to create the Himi character. She's completely useless in battle. She's completely useless as a party leader. And she has, I am not kidding, she has about 10 lines of text in the whole game.
Wow.
She is the worst character I have ever seen in a game besides like Suikoden that has about 200 characters.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't Chrono Cross. There's only 8 characters. Do something with that.
I think Umuro in Final Fantasy VI probably has more than 10 lines of dialogue, and he doesn't speak English.
She is unbelievably bad.
If she has 10 lines, are any of them dot, dot, dot?
No, 10 lines where she actually says stuff.
Okay.
She might have some dot, dot, dots thrown in there, or some emotion bubble reactions, but she really only has like 10 lines of text. This is an exaggeration or anything. She doesn't talk. But what's more troubling about the game is, and this isn't really a spoiler because it's been in all the PR material, they talk about how the game is about these Psy Energy vortexes that are popping up all over the world. And I mean, there's one on the cover, and not Isaac, as I have been calling him, Isaac being the main character of the first game, but he looks just like him, is standing in front of one of these things. Comes up at the beginning of the game, forgotten. It's like the plot just like, let's do something else. I don't care.
And they never go back to it?
So this might be a spoiler, so skip ahead if you don't want to hear it. Maybe about 10 seconds. They do come back to it at the very end of the game, and then they say, the end, ellipses, question mark.
Oh, no.
Flash Gordon, that stuff.
Does the world really need more Golden Sun?
I think it does.
I'm not even sure it needed this Golden Sun.
I mean, James, do you think the obvious comparison is with the previous Golden Sun games, but do you think because it stayed so similar, it's just been passed by handheld RPGs in general? I mean, the storytelling, everything about it is just kind of feels a bit quaint compared to what's out there now.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the previous... There are still moments in the game where the world of Wayard is cool. I mean, it's a neat world. There's interesting things that happen in it. There are mysteries from the first two games that are solved in this game.
On the DS, though, man, there's some tough RPG competition
there. There is.
And I mean, there's so many good RPGs to choose from.
I mean, it still uses its hyper-traditional battle system with the Jin element on top of it. So that's basically where the game gets its uniqueness, is the Jin. Mm-hmm. And that's still there, and It looks cool. The summon animations are cool.
Is it still broken?
It's not totally broken. But the game itself is so easy, you might not notice it's broken anyway.
So even if you haven't played the other Golden Sun games, in which case the redundancy factor isn't an issue for you, is it still advisable to try it, given what else is out there?
It's a good game. I gave it like a 7.5, but it's not a great game, which is a little upsetting. If you've not played the Golden Sun games, it's going to feel a little quaint, but the sameness probably won't come into play. And they do a very, very good job of creatively introducing new players to the gameplay mechanics and the world as a whole without alienating people who played the original two games and still remember them the life of a first grader later.
Well, James, you mentioned that you're now caught up playing a bunch of other stuff. Is there anything that you want to talk about from what you've picked up since finishing and reviewing Golden Sun?
Well, I haven't really talked all that much about Donkey Kong, though. I did talk about it a little bit on the live show.
Yeah, what do you think?
It's hard. I mean, that's
I agree.
That's kind of where I am. It's just hard.
How far have you gotten?
World 7, I think.
You're farther than me, then.
Like, up to World 5, I was like, yeah, this is fine. And then World 5 comes along, and it's like, nope. No, here comes the brick wall. And that's when the lives start to drain away.
Also, if you play two-player, you will burn through some balloons really fast.
I've been guessing that was the case.
I didn't really feel like the game was harder with two people because, as they noted in the Iwata Asks with Retro Studios, it's different than in Mario on the Wii because your characters can overlap. They don't actually interact with each other.
They can't be a douchebag and push you off the edge of a cliff. Yes.
Right, right. Yeah, and you can't pick each other up and throw each other or anything like that. So you can almost play the game as if you were playing it single player, except you've got someone to help you pick up bananas and stuff. The bonus stages become a lot easier.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
So the way that you play through the levels doesn't feel all that different. You just lose twice as many lives because you're both going to die in the same places that you would have died if you were playing by yourself. But it takes away a balloon each time. The nice thing is, though, in some sequences and in some boss battles, you won't have to reset as much back to the beginning or back to the last checkpoint.
Yeah.
Because if one person dies, if you can get the other person in and break them out of the barrel before the second person dies, then you can kind of keep a chain going. So basically one person can die as many times as they want as long as both of you don't die at the same time. And that's useful. And again, that's actually quite a bit different than in Mario.
Yeah, what frustrates me with this game is sometimes the checkpoint placement feels not helpful.
Mm.
And there are some boss battles that go on really long.
Yeah, I found the boss designs to be very uneven.
The boss battles generally, obviously they're better than the DKC ones, the original DKC, because they were awful. That's not much of a commendation.
Right.
Beyond that, I am happy that they're not just like the bop it three times on the head Mario
yeah.
style. There's more to them than that. And there is often kind of three phases to it.
Right.
Nintendo's rule of three still applies, but it's dressed up a little more. It's not quite that straightforward. But I do feel like they are generally too long. There's not enough to them to drag them out as long as they are dragged out.
My primary offender is the minecart one.
Yeah, that was one yes. I certainly felt similarly.
And to what end? Is it just to make them harder?
I think they wanted to make the bosses feel like their own levels. Because that is the only thing in that level. And I think they wanted to make it feel like it was as much content as playing a level.
It's not at the end of a castle or anything like in Mario,
right.
So I could see that. But also, in terms of making them harder, I mean, I suppose it does to some degree, but they have a habit of giving out hearts during the battle.
Right.
So the fact that it is longer doesn't necessarily make it harder.
It just makes it longer.
It is just, yeah, I think Johnny's onto it there. Really, there isn't quite enough to the patterns or the forms or whatever to
yeah,
actually
sustain
that. Yeah,
they start to feel repetitive. I mean, that fucking crab boss in level 2. In
oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good grief. That took like 10 minutes. It was just the same thing over and over.
Especially if you don't manage to hit all three of them, because then it's basically like you haven't done anything.
Yeah. Oh, that's a terrible boss.
Yeah. The reason I hate the minecart boss the most, though, is that usually it'll give you hearts when you don't need them.
That I kind of noticed that.
It's like, oh, you're down to one heart. Not giving you any more hearts now. Suck it up, son.
So yeah, I wasn't thrilled with the boss. I think they were kind of good enough. I mean, they're not often like the best parts of Nintendo platformers bosses.
The sad thing is the bosses are some of the best parts of the Metroid Prime games.
Definitely, I think, after the first one, they really... Mm-hmm. Two has awesome boss battles. Three does kind of commit the same sin of some of them being too damn long, though.
Yeah, but they're always really interesting and
more interesting, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. Even in the first game, I mean, I think like that big plant boss is awesome. I mean, it can be frustrating, but it's really cool. And there was several bosses. I mean, The ice guy. I'm sorry, I'm bad with names. I mean, I love
Thardis.
Thardis. Oh, he's brutally hard, but he's awesome. That's an epic battle.
That's too long for me. There's not enough to you could apply quite a few of the same complaints as far as I'm concerned to some of those.
See, I'd much rather my boss battles be brutal and short, essentially. Be like really savage affairs that end quickly.
Yeah, I think there's a problem of, you know, boss battles for me a lot of the time, you're looking for them to be intense, and when you string them out, they lose that intensity.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, and Mario has the same problem, but I mean, Mario and especially Donkey Kong Country, these are not combat-oriented games. I'm not sure that they need bosses. I mean, you can have a what feels like a boss level, and Mario 64 and Galaxy and Galaxy 2 have done really well with that, with the Bowser stages, where it feels like the entire level is taking it up a notch, and it's really intense, and it's challenging. The actual boss battle at the end with Bowser or with any of these Donkey Kong bosses is usually not that great because these platformers are not about combat. Your characters don't really have that many combat abilities to take advantage of in the design.
Yeah, it always seems like there's a boss, so here's a boss because you have to have one, right?
It's an obligation.
We got to have them, right? And yeah, I don't think
you do. I mean, if you can't, I mean, I love boss battles. These are some of my favorite parts of great games, but if you can't do them right, don't do them.
Well, see, here's the thing about, like, the Galaxy 2 boss battles. Like, the Bowser Jr. ones were great.
And yeah, they were awesome.
They were combat, but they were leveraged heavily on the platforming element.
You know, like using the cloud power-up, for instance, on the one that sort of grows and becomes a giant
that
tower.
Tough.
Your job was to climb. But the Bowser boss battles, I mean, at least things were still happening. There wasn't a lot of waiting.
It was fine the first time. That's all I'll say about that.
Well, I have a question. I have a comment in about Donkey Kong, and I want to get your guys' reaction to it. I've complained a lot in our forums and on Facebook about the controls for this game and how I think especially in Worlds 2 and 3, I ran into a series of levels that I found to be infuriating. There's one in particular where you're crossing this series of platforms and they're either crumbling or tilting underneath you, so they're all, basically you can't stand on any platform for more than like 2 seconds. And that's fine, but there's also these enemies hovering left and right over most of the platforms, and they look like suns, and they hurt you if you touch. There's no way to kill them. You can't roll through them. They're difficult to jump over, and the only way to avoid them is to duck, and you can't do that because the platform is crumbling underneath you. And that section took me probably 20 tries to get through, and I was like, what the fuck?
I mean, that is surprising because there was nothing my experience was similar to James, where he said, you know, the life started to decrease at like Worlds 4 and 5. Mm-hmm. So that kind of surprises me. But on the general point, one thing, if you haven't picked up Donkey Kong Country Returns yet and you're wondering how much you might like it, I would ask you, do you like, or can you tolerate at least in old school games, auto-scrolling levels? Because a lot of this game is like that.
Yes.
It might not literally be auto-scrolling. Sometimes it's like, oh, there's the swarm of ants.
Oh, I hate that one, yeah.
Or there's levels where the ground is collapsing a lot. But this game keeps propelling you forward relentlessly. It does not let you sort of sit there and wait so you can establish the timing of like these enemies that are hovering next to you. So you have got to keep going. And I actually like that. I find it exciting, it's tense, it's taxing, you know, I've dealt with it in old school games and I could deal with it here. But I know from, you know, previous games that some people just don't like that. They don't like the whole auto-scrolling type of deal. And if you don't, you might not be all that in love with DKCR.
Yeah. So I mean, like the one level that mimics Johnny's experience here was, there was a level, I think it's in 5, where the whole level is vines. The whole level.
Yeah.
And I lost, God, I went into that with like 30 lives and ran the fuck out.
Well, quite capture the way that it should feel when you jump from one vine to another.
See, here's the thing.
It doesn't feel clean enough.
It's the Z trigger, right? Yeah, the Z trigger that you have to press, the timing for it is very, very precise.
To grab?
Yes.
Well, you could just hold it down the whole time. You don't have to tap it or anything.
To make it grab the next vine?
Yeah, you just hold it.
Oh, Jesus. No wonder
I
lost
just
so many
jump button.
Yeah. Well, see, the thing is that this is an interesting sort of point because I guess you're using the analog, the nunchuck scheme.
Yes.
James. Johnny used the nunchuck scheme as well?
I've been going back and forth. I think I prefer the NES style, but they're both about the same. I mean,
I definitely prefer the NES style.
The difference between joystick and D-pad is kind of immaterial to me. They both have the same waggle shit, so I find the NES controller to be a little more comfortable. So.
They definitely have the issue of the motion control either way, which is definitely an issue, as we've discussed before. But for me, what I liked about NES style, first of all, I'm kind of used to doing the shaking motion on that for New Super Mario Brothers, so I kind of just do this sort of little thrust down. That was very reliable for me in New Super Mario Brothers Wii, so I kind of just maintained the same technique. And you know, at this point, there's very rarely that I find the recognition lets me down. The problem is more the question of there's an inherent lag that comes with the gesture. That's really the issue, rather than the recognition. But the other thing I liked about that was the fact that rather than the analog stick controlling how fast DK runs, you've just got a run button, essentially.
Right.
With the NES style. And when I played Mario World, I pretty much played it holding the run button for dear life, even though it's definitely not the prudent way to do it. And I still like to play my platformers that way. So I kind of just played DKCR clenching that run button down all the time.
It's not even a run button, though. It doesn't do anything unless you're on Rambi.
No, it definitely increases his average movement speed if you just have it
holding down the
grab button.
The one button? That makes him run faster? I had no idea. I mean, I knew that it grabbed, but that might help me on some of these levels.
Yeah, see, that's what I was thinking, because for me, it's easier to keep it at full speed just with that button held down than making sure you've always got the analog stick all the way over to the one side.
Sure. Yeah.
And so that's what made me think, because you said in the forums, you said the times you felt his movement speed was inadequate. And I was like, well, I never encountered that. And then I started to think about the difference between how DK speed is handled between the two schemes.
I might be playing this game wrong. So with that knowledge, let me just say, first off, to your earlier point about people might like this game if they're okay with games that auto-scroll or make you move forward for whatever reason, I think I'm fine either way. I like more contemplative platformers like Super Meat Boy, where you can usually take as much time as you want. Not always, but often you can take time to think about this jump and try to steel yourself for it or whatever. And then I also like Bit Trip Runner, which, you know, is literally auto-scrolling. It's pretty much the game.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it doesn't matter to me, and I enjoy a lot of the levels in Donkey Kong where it's more fast-paced. In fact, I would say the game actually started to pick back up for me, and I'm actually kind of up on it right now. I feel I'm enjoying it more now that I'm in like around world 5 or so, because I've just gone through a couple of worlds where most of the levels I went through that cave world, and that world I really, really like because there's no platforming. Every level you're either in the rocket barrel or you're in the minecart, which means all you have to do is basically push a button. It's still hard and it's still interesting and it's still fun. But you don't have to, there's no waggle, it's all just to push a button, it's more digital. I don't have to worry about trying to run and jump and deal with these controls.
Especially the minecart stuff, he's getting into Bit Trip Runner kind of territory there
sure.
at times,
yeah.
in terms of like,
it's
you've got to duck in the minecart to get under the crystalline spikes and jump
at
this point.
I love that stuff.
But don't you think though, because those gameplay styles are so kind of discreet from the rest of the game, you know, you're in a minecart, you're on the barrel, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a case there. I don't know why, you know, this is such a sort of line not to be crossed, it seems, but where they could actually sort of waive the normal lives continue structure and just have it so that it does restart really quickly, like something like Runner. Because you're so much more likely to die at any moment in those levels.
Oh, God, yes.
You know, as much as I love hearing again and again and again, you know, because it was in the original, I could do without that where death can be so frequent.
I felt like it was the same with the boss battles, though. It was like you get the awesome music and then you have to go watch the stupid video again, right, till you hammer on
well,
A
you could, yeah, you could skip it, but it's still a little bit of something.
It still makes you watch the first second or two.
The great thing about Runner, you know, considering how often you will die in some of those levels, that kind of salvages it in a way, is how instant the restart is, which apparently was something that was strongly suggested to them by one of the people involved with Super Meat Boy, I think, was adamant that that could could help the game. And I just think, what, you know, you've got these very separate stages where death is omnipresent, essentially. Yeah. Why not just give it its own little structure?
The rocket barrel was really bad about that, because,
I mean, to be fair, I mean, the lives really don't mean a whole hell of a lot. You know, it's not like you've got to get to a safe point on the map like you did with the original DKC.
Right. Yeah, it just doesn't. This is a game we should be post lives at this point. I'm not saying post death. You don't have to go to Kirby levels. You can still die.
Yeah.
But why do we have balloons in this game?
Yeah, it seems pretty arbitrary.
It's vestigial at this point. It means nothing.
It does mean something, because I ran out of them one time. I
mean, what happened, James?
I had to restart the whole level.
Well, yeah, you lost your checkpoint.
Yes.
You lost a checkpoint. I mean, come on. These levels take 2 minutes to get through.
This one didn't. It took 2 hours.
But that's the point, though. It's minor enough to be kind of trivial in the structure of the game, but significant enough to still be irritating.
Yes.
So when you run out of lives, though, so in this case, it was a struggle to get as far as I did. And then when I ran out of lives, I was like, shit, there's no way I'm going to accomplish that feat again. And it took me like 10 lives to get back to that damn checkpoint. And then I was like, well, we've got 10 left.
But I mean, don't forget, I mean, you're probably going to be rolling in the banana coins all the time. And you could just go and buy lives
buy seven
from the
lives.
Shop before.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, I know. I mean, that's what I ended up doing when I continued. I was like, I could go back and collect lives, but I've got like 250 banana coins. Just go buy them.
I mean, I didn't even bother, but I mean, I could have done if I wanted to. But it's just trivial. It's just not worth keeping.
Guys, we need to move on. Greg, is there anything other than Donkey Kong that you'd like to talk about?
No, well, it's been a lot of Donkey Kong. I've seen every level now. The secret levels that I've seen, I enjoyed those a lot. Very taxing, very cool. I enjoyed it really thoroughly. It certainly kept me sort of going at it a lot more zealously than Mario did last year. Just because it's a little bit tougher. Like I said, it's a little more exciting. I think I haven't really settled on whether I kind of like it better than Wario Land. I mean, it certainly is quite different. You know, it serves you in a different way, I would say.
It's almost a different genre.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think Wario Land is more clever and it's prettier. You know, that beautiful hand-drawn animation
It's also
style.
4-3 for some reason.
I don't see there's much reason to compare the two, really.
But Donkey Kong is, you know, exciting and it's spectacular. There's just, you know, crazy stuff going on in the background, all this stuff. So I really did enjoy it. So as a counterpoint to DK, you know, because it's far too easy, I have been playing Ghosts and Goblins Arcade.
Ah, yes.
Which is incredibly difficult.
Is it the hardest one of all the Ghosts and Goblins?
Yes.
And
yeah,
yes.
I think so.
There is no question that is the hardest one.
Bollocks, that's what I say.
I basically got it because it is supposed to be one of the hardest games ever made.
I've never made it out of like the second area.
I've got to the very end of the last level. But of course, if I were to beat that last level, I presumably would have to go around again.
Of course you would.
I thought they only did that in the Super.
No.
That's a feature of the series.
It's a series staple, gosh. I think.
It's such bullshit, and it's every time.
I'm not sure I've got the guts to do it again.
It's like, yep, this is a game you have to pay quarters to play, but you still have to go around.
But I mean, I don't think the
I don't think the
special weapon that you have to use is as awful relative to the others
the
in the
ring.
Game. Well, it's more just that all the weapons kind of suck in this one relative to it's closer to the field.
It's like being armed with a torch
you
all the time.
You are a rare breed, Greg Leahy. I mean, what is wrong with you that you're playing this game?
I enjoy this
as hard as it is, right? It doesn't take you long to see that much of it. If you can pass the levels, yes, you will die a hell of a lot in a short span of time, but, you know, it's a brief game. It was an arcade game, you know, from 85. I mean, this is old. It actually looks pretty good for a game from 85. There's little, nice little animation touches to, like, Arthur as he runs along. His little helmet sort of bobs up and down and stuff. It's cute.
It looks markedly similar to the SNES game that came out quite a few years later.
Yeah, like 6 years later. I mean, because it was an arcade game at the time. Obviously, you know, the Famicom /NES port would not do it justice. I've seen comparisons. You know, it looks a hell of a lot better than that. But gameplay-wise, it's still really simple. Because, you know, what Ghouls and Ghosts did was let you sort of shoot up.
Yes. Which is useful.
Which was, yeah, useful, but it also let them put way more enemies and stuff happening.
Which they did, because they're compensate. Douchebags.
And then with Super Ghouls of Ghosts, you could double jump, and also you had stuff like the bow and arrow weapon, which let you kind of shoot at a 45-degree angle and things. So, yeah, those two games, because they made the gameplay a bit more refined, a bit more complicated, they could throw more things at you to make it still comparably evil. Whereas with this one, you know, it's so straightforward, it has to be pretty limited in what it can do.
So what I find amusing is that this game is available on the Apple iPod Touch.
Yeah, it's just a perfect blend.
Which pretty much makes me think I would kill myself. Right, because I remember playing this game years ago in the old dumpy arcade that only had games from the 80s, and just unloading just rolls and rolls of quarters into it, because it would be like, two steps, you're dead. Son of a bitch, next quarter.
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, I can't imagine play this without anything but the most deliberate control scheme, because you do have to, even though your controls are very simple, it's not too much of a platformer, this one, but you've still got to be very careful with your jump because it's so, so limited. And there's at times where you will need to, like, vault over some big enemies, which requires some, you know, pretty precise jumping,
oh, yeah,
for instance. And there's other times where you're going to want to crouch. For instance, yeah. So I can't fathom playing this on something like that.
I want John to go download it during the break so he can tell us how it plays.
So, Greg, mechanically, is it pretty much the same as the NES version?
I can only assume it would be. I've never played that.
It is. It's got to be.
I mean, there's no need to change something. It's perfect. I mean,
I still think, even though there's not too much going on, I don't think the NES version would have had the same amount of enemies on screen at once. Especially some of the more like complicated ones, like the Red Arima or whatever it's called, the thing that's basically in Gargoyle's Quest, the Demon's Crest. You know, that devil character that just flies in at you.
Firebrand.
Oh, he's that thing. He's evil.
He's an ass.
I mean, he's so much faster than you are.
Yeah, oh my god.
I mean, he's so much faster.
Especially
that's funny
in this,
because he's actually really slow in Gargoyle's Quest and Demon's Crest.
Still, you know, as much as I like the idea of playing Demon's Crest because it sounds so awesome, I'm not sure I could play as that character after what he's put me through in Ghouls and Ghosts.
He's not really the same character. He's actually kind of slow in Demon's Crest, yeah. So it's funny that you say that.
He looks the similar. For me, it might, at this point, after all the pain he's inflicted on me, it might be like playing the Patriots in Madden.
But you know you do when you have a little in you, you know, maybe have a couple of beers. Let's see what it's like to be Belichick. Start calling some plays, maybe.
I love that.
Only once, and he was in college. He was experimenting.
Love that Capcom said, you know, this guy's a serious ass. Let's make a 3-game spin-off series starring him.
Yeah. Yep.
This is going to really endear ourselves to the people.
Basically, because I think everyone probably felt like I did, that God, this enemy is a complete bastard.
And then when they think, oh man, I'm going to be so awesome in this.
Yeah.
Fucking
and
useless.
Then actually you're really slow and you can't do jack shit.
Who did this?
I can't say enough about Demon's Crest. That game is it's basically like, it's like a gothic Mega Man X. It's awesome.
Which is funny because the Mega Man series actually has some Ghost and Goblins themed stuff in it, which is kind of weird.
Yeah, that was a dirty trick that TYP played on Radio Trivia once.
That was,
he loves doing that.
Oh, that's awful.
Well. We need to move on, guys. We're getting a little long in the tooth here with this segment. So, John.
Okay.
Are you ready for this?
What games have you not been playing?
Other than WoW, because I think we probably got WoW out of our system on the live show.
For the next how many years?
I've not got Cataclysm yet, I'll have you know.
Oh, that's right. That's
because
right.
Of the whole debacle where I ordered it and it got shipped to my old house back in Atlanta. So.
Oh.
Yeah.
So somebody's now got Cataclysm. What the hell is this thing?
It's called a stay of execution.
No, I just had to reorder it and had him send it back to Amazon, but so it's coming. And all you guys are going.
What?
Anyways.
You were saying you've been playing some stuff on Wii, right? I know Black Ops was part of it, but was there anything else?
Yeah, I played SSX Blur, actually.
My wife
really likes snowboarding games, and of course I...
So you found one serving as a coaster in a bar is what you're telling us.
If James would stop talking, I would... I did remember, if you recall, I did get 1080 snowboarding, and it was terrible. But I managed to get SSX Blur fairly cheap. I think it was about $20 on Amazon, so I figured, what the hell. And yeah, it's pretty good. I mean, the controls are pretty cool. The graphics aren't bad. They slow down a little bit because, I mean, it's from 2007, so it was sort of that first launch wave, I think.
It was developed on a GameCube, yes.
It was early 2007.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, EA has just seemed to have completely abandoned that entire EA Big line.
Well, I just heard a rumor this week that EA Canada might be making a new SSX based on the Skate
engine, yes.
Format, yeah.
That'd be awesome.
And not only is the rumor that they've been making is that they've been making it for like 2 years.
Oh, good, good.
Like it's almost done, basically.
I love SSX. I didn't play Blur. So Blur has some kind of wacky motion controls, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. They're kind of hard to learn. Apparently, from the reviews that I've read of it, they're the kind of thing where if you're just looking for some incredibly easy sort of moves to pull off, it's kind of hard. Like, in other words, if you're looking for something without a learning curve, which is funny because I think the whole idea of putting those motion controls in was, I guess, to make it simpler or easier for people that, you know, aren't used to, you know, use like playing those games with a controller, a regular controller. But I think it had the exact opposite effect, where it made it harder to pull off all the different kinds of moves you can do. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty fun. The main thing that I don't like about it is, you know, there's no online in it. And so you're pretty much stuck with, you know, you can play through the one player stuff and do all that. But in terms of playing with other people, which I think is the real fun of it, it's really just you against one other person. You can do races. And I don't know if there's anything unlockable, because I haven't put a whole lot of time into, like, you know, unlocking the whole game, because pretty much my wife and I, we just dove right into the two-player. So you can do split-screen, racing, and kind of beating somebody based on points. And it's fun, and you can see that there's a really good time to be had there, but it just gets kind of old.
So can you interfere with each other's racing?
Like throw snowballs or shoot rockets?
Or just run into them?
You can throw snowballs. And I think you might be able to, like, knock the other person down.
Good.
So, I mean, you can, yeah, I'm pretty sure you can. You can definitely throw snowballs.
So you're saying you haven't been griefing your wife every time you guys race?
Well, seriously? No, because I've just been trying to figure out the controls. You know? Because, well, that's the thing, the game moves so
fast.
Once I do, I'm going to be taking her out left, right, and center.
I guess snowboarders have plenty of time to make snowballs when they're sitting on their ass right in the middle of your run. Skiers have poles and turns to make, so we don't have time to make snowballs on the way down the mountain. You're not gonna play a skiing game where you can throw snowballs.
This is the straight, because you're not going to play a skiing game.
You could play Touché. You could play Wii Ski.
Just say it, I got you.
You could play Wii Ski and snowboard.
Whiskey doesn't count, and Whiskey probably does have snowballs.
Well, for the record, in SSX Blur, you can also choose to use skis as well. So
there you go.
Okay, and my other game, so SSX Blur, it's good. Really wish I had some more online. That's that. I don't know how it compares to something like Shaun White snowboarding. I'd imagine since that game's newer, it probably has, you know, probably more to it, more meat to it.
Do you feel like it needed the Hawk board? I think that would have helped things any.
I think it definitely would have. You know, I think it would have helped if it had the shred board. But that's, I feel that way about every game, especially the one that I'm going to talk about next, which is Gran Turismo 5. Ah, you like that segue?
Which probably does support the shred board.
It probably does. It's, yeah. I mean, again, it's one of these games. I feel like it's like a lot of these games, like, you know, like Halo Reach and everything. It's again one of these games where if you like the series, you're going to love this game. If you don't like the series, it's not going to convert you. I've always wondered why the Gran Turismo franchise is as popular as it is when it really doesn't even try to be. I mean, it's like James described it as car porn. And it really doesn't like try to like aspire to be anything but that. I know there's been, this kind of gotten a mixed reaction.
So one of the, because the car porn description is kind of funny because they up-resed the vast majority of their cars from a PS2 version of the series. And it felt kind of weird since it's car porn.
Well,
I mean, the game was in development for like 6 years.
But it's like, you know, like I'm neither like enough of a Sony fanboy or enough of a I'm not enough of a Sony hater, I should say, or enough of a GT5 fanboy to really care about that kind of stuff. It's like,
yeah, I just thought that was kind of odd. They got blowback on that. And that's one of the things I saw blowback on.
Well, yeah. So what you're talking about, James, is there are about 1,000 cars in the game.
Yes.
And about 200 of them are premium models that are brand new, very HD. They modeled the cockpit of them and everything.
Yeah. Right.
And then the other 800 are standard models that are pretty much PS2 models. I think, like you said, they're kind of up-res. They look a little bit nicer, but they're essentially the same from GT4, which was released 5-6 years ago.
They've been developing it since then.
Yeah, so the weird thing to me is if they had just included the 200 premium models and those were the cars in Gran Turismo 5, wouldn't that be enough? I mean, 200 cars, they've still got more
no,
than any other video.
No, it wouldn't have, just because the whole thing, I mean, because this is an iterative game, everything has to be bigger and,
yes,
and more expansive.
I don't necessarily think that's a good philosophy.
I don't know. It's like GT5, I mean, I'm enjoying it for what it is. It's a very good, you know, car, like it's a very good driving simulator. You know, other things that people have said is that, you know, it's has kind of a half-baked, you know, community aspect to it. You have like your GT5 profile.
Right.
And there's like a little kind of board where you can post comments, and everybody that's on your friends list that also has GT5 can see those comments and post if they want. I think you can create a chat room, like you go to the lounge and you can create a chat room and chat with people and stuff like that.
Oh yeah, the lounge, that was what it was called.
Yeah,
yes.
The lounge. And all that kind of stuff is cool, but it's like, it just seems kind of like, if you're going to criticize the game for that, I mean, I don't play Gran Turismo 5 to have something that emulates Twitter. I don't really give a shit.
I mean, most of the comments that I saw that were negative were either the up-res or stuff like that.
Yeah, it reminds me, it kind of reminds me of Final Fantasy 13 in the sense that it was in development so long, it almost took on a life of its own.
Yeah.
So people were disappointed. Like, people would be disappointed regardless of how it was when it came out. Like, the fact that it cost so much money to make, like, I think they said it cost $60 million to make.
Yes, it was the most expensive game that Sony has ever produced.
Yeah, and, you know, just all that kind of stuff, it kind of, like, snowballs into this huge kind of, like, this game has to be the shit or it's an utter failure kind of reaction to it.
It's so polarized reaction.
Yeah.
And what a lot of the haters will say about it, which is the funniest thing in the world, really, is They'll slam it for like having 1,000 cars, and they'll go, but you know, whatever Microsoft series is, has 800 cars and they're all high res.
Yeah, I mean, like Forza, like, okay.
It's like, that took 3 years to make, and like, oh god.
I think a lot of the hype and the crazy fervor about this game comes down to the fact that it's a PS3 exclusive and Forza is an Xbox exclusive.
Oh yeah, there's no question.
There's a lot of system wars with a Z going on, and
yeah.
I don't give a fuck about either one of them.
My favorite comments I've seen in the System Wars for this one is, I guess there's kind of like this cart mode in this game that's, uh-huh, that people felt like, why in the hell did they had a cart mode?
Yeah.
And so people are like, they didn't up-res all their cars, but they added a cart mode. What's wrong with these people? And they're like, well, we have a cart mode. It's
yeah.
Like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, that's one
have
of
the... Have you tried the cart mode, John?
I haven't tried it yet, but it's one of the events that you can unlock when it, like, it's a go-kart. I haven't tried it yet, but...
Is it like professional go-karts?
Yes.
I don't know if there's such a thing.
So the pictures you see are guys in, like, track suits.
Awesome.
Like full racing suits with the helmets driving around in these metal frame go-karts.
Yep.
So they're like miniature F1 racers.
Yeah, they're
very
like little,
miniature.
They're like little tiny go-karts. Like if you went to like the go-kart track that you and your buddies go and drink at, you know what I mean?
Hell
like
yeah.
It would be the most high-end go-karts they have there, but yeah, it's like that.
Go-karts are the only reason I ever go to Florida.
Yep, like there's more you can unlock, but I think there's about eight events that you can unlock, different types of things like training, like you can, I think
isn't
there's
there NASCAR?
Yeah, there's like NASCAR training with Jeff Gordon is in there, which is just ripe for jokes.
It's
in
like,
itself.
What can we tack on this game to delay it 6 months?
Yeah.
NASCAR, do it.
Well, John, I'm glad you're enjoying it. I guess, you know, I have no interest whatsoever, but I really wish those guys at Polyphony would go make Omega Boost 2 or something like that, because I really like that game. It's been a long time.
If they started, it'd be a long time before you got it, too.
Yeah.
Well, I guess they made that bike game a few years ago, like TT Racers or something like that, but that didn't interest me either. But Omega Boost is this PS1 mech game.
Oh, yeah.
That looked incredible and was really fun. And it's just, man, that's been a long time ago that they made that. But I liked that game a lot. I wish they'd go back and do something like that.
That noise that noise you just heard was me tapping on my copy of Omega Boost, which is right there.
Yeah, Gran Turismo 5 really strikes me as one of those games where it's a product of a different time. When it was okay to spend $60 million and develop a huge game that really isn't leaps and bounds beyond anything else out
that?
There.
Jesus.
I'm just saying, like, it reminds me of, like, a game of this scope and, like, a project this big probably sounded really good back about 2004, the same time when Square Enix was greenlighting Final Fantasy 13. You know what I mean?
Maybe they worked out together.
Yeah.
How's your game going? 3 years left.
Maybe next year Sony will release a combo pack of FF13 and GT5. They'll call it the Albatross Pack.
How much time is it going to take to add that extra 200 cars? About 4 years.
It's $120 million in one package.
Yep.
Yours for only $30.
20 right. years of development, 3 games, Final Fantasy 13, Gran Turismo 5, and Duke Nukem Forever.
That's like 30 years of development, Sean.
I know, really. Yeah. Who am I kidding?
All right, well, We gotta wrap this up. So I played this week a fantastic WiiWare game called Fluidity. There's a demo up. If you haven't played the demo, you really should. And the demo I found to be very impressive, and that's why I went and paid my $12 for it. But if you've played the demo and you think, oh, this is really neat, I wonder how much more there is to it. Let me tell you, I'm still early in the full game, but it appears that the scope of Fluidity is enormous for a WiiWare game. I mean, way bigger than I would have thought. So this seems like a game that's going to take well over 10, maybe 15 hours to complete, because it has 90 of these rainbow drops, which are kind of like your Mario stars or the things you're trying to get.
Right.
And every time you get one, it kind of resets you back to the beginning. But now things in the world will change a little bit. Sometimes it'll open up a shortcut, or you might have a new power, and now you can go somewhere else. And the levels are just enormous. And there's 4 chapters. Each one is made up of, I think, 3 pages. And each one of the pages is made up of like 7 or 8. They look like comic book panels. And each one of those is larger than a screen. So it's really an enormous game. And it seems like it's just jammed full of creativity. So the premise of Fluidity is that you're controlling this blob of water, and you control it by tilting the Wii remote. So it plays similarly to something like Dewey's Adventure or Mercury Meltdown Revolution to early Wii games.
Yeah.
But this is all done in 2D. It actually looks a lot like Pixel Junk Shooter.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, have you played this, Greg?
No, I've had my eye on it. For our European listeners, it's coming out in Europe on Christmas Eve under the name of Hydro Venture, just to... continue,
you know,
Nintendo
that's a good
of
name
Europe's,
for it,
well, it's, but it just continues Nintendo of Europe's questionable need to keep messing around with names.
Let's give it a different name. Yeah. Let's not piggyback on any of the Western VR.
Especially for the download services. You know, games coverage is very international today, so I don't really see why they feel the need to cultivate confusion with the identity of these games all the time. There you go.
It's like they're deliberately saying, let's not piggyback on this PR at all.
Yeah.
You know, it could be a matter of which copyrights are available in different regions.
Fair enough, yeah. It could be a Star Wing thing.
Do you think you'd sort that out before you named it in all the regions so it would just stick together? I mean, in the end, this is all going to the same bank account.
But yeah, a couple of weeks' time, this looks really cool.
It is really cool, and I think you especially will like it, Greg, because it has a feeling, I mean, Fluidity tells you it's about water, but it doesn't really tell you what kind of game it is.
Mm.
And Hydro Venture is maybe even a better name because it actually feels like an adventure game.
It's that expansive.
It really is that expansive. It's very open. You can kind of go any direction you want. There's multiple things to do in every direction. There's different ways, there's different like pathways connecting different sections of the level. So it's all very sort of non-linearly designed. And as you play, you pick up powers. It seems to happen infrequently. So normally all you do is tilt the controller. That's all you do.
Right.
And so there's all these gates and pumps and tons of different level mechanics and little features in the level design that cause your water to behave certain ways when you get to, you know, to different parts. It's very, very interesting. The number of things that they've come up with to take advantage of the fact that you're kind of controlling this fluid. And one of the things Aaron Kaluska noted in his impressions of it, that one of the things about playing the game is it feels kind of like you're herding cats because you've got all these, this water is, you know, disassociative. So, I mean, it doesn't really stick together. So you can easily take a bunch of your water through a door and leave some behind. You can kind of slide over a ledge and then raise up and leave some of it still hanging on the ledge while some more of it's down here. So it can get to a point where, you know, you're kind of controlling this water, but you're really controlling the level more.
Yeah.
And the water can get spread out. And if it's spread out long enough, then some of it will start to evaporate, and if too much of that happens, you'll like lose a life or whatever. So you really kind of want to, generally speaking, you want to keep the water together. But the first power you get is called Gather, and it just lets you push the one button anytime you want to, and it'll basically cause all the water to like magnetically attract together into one pool. It doesn't always work because some of the water droplets might be stuck behind a door, or they're just behind a ledge and the attraction isn't enough to overcome the physics to get them around the corner. Of course, you can tilt in conjunction with that. You can also bounce the Wii Remote up and it'll cause the water to jump. It basically shakes the level, but it effectively lets you jump the water up into the air. And so there's platforming challenges, but you're not controlling a character. You're controlling this like puddle that is all kind of loosely connected, and some of it might make the jump and some of it might fall down. And the question is, well, is that good enough? Do I want to continue on with what did make the jump, or do I want to go back down and gather it all up and try it again? The gather ability, which you get pretty early, I'd say within 15 minutes of starting the game, it makes a lot of those things less frustrating because you can sort of use it judiciously as you jump the puddle. While it's in midair, you can hit gather and it kind of collects it all together. So there's a nice balance in that you can't hold it down for too long because the water will just kind of spray out and you'll have to recollect it again. So you can't hold down gather all the time because then you just have a blob of water and it wouldn't be as interesting.
Yeah.
But you can use it quite a bit, and especially if you kind of feather it, you know, and you just use it a little bit at a time, you can use it very effectively to keep everything unified as you move through these levels. It feels great. It looks absolutely beautiful. I mean, I don't know that I've played a game that looks quite like it, but the closest thing is definitely the Pixel Junk series, especially Shooter, because it has so much fluid in it already. But it's all done in 2D. The structure of the level is paneled out like a comic book, but the art style actually looks more like a watercolor type thing. It's not abstract at all, but it's a very charming, cartoony look to it. And the quality of the puzzles I've been extremely pleased with. I found a number of the platforming challenges and just the straight puzzles that you have to solve with these water mechanics have been very creative and really satisfying, even early in the game where I am. So I can't wait to play more of it. I would say for $12, I think it's absolutely worth it.
Mm.
Absolutely. I think this is basically the World of Goo of this year, but I like it better than World of Goo. I really do. The music is really good too. Everything about it is just really, really tight. I'm not surprised at all that Nintendo decided to publish this. I mean, if I was running a big company and I played this game in like a production demo, I'd say, yeah, we're going to sell this.
It sounds like it's right up Nintendo's alley too.
It comes across almost, it seems experimental, like an art style game.
Yeah.
But it's so much more fully developed and fleshed out into a full game than one of those. It doesn't feel like a tech demo. It doesn't feel like a mini game. It feels like a full-on adventure game.
Yeah.
You're just using these sort of experimental mechanics. It's awesome, dude. It's really, really good. I highly recommend Fluidity. The other game I've been playing, well, I played it before Thanksgiving, actually. I just rented it, and I played through it over the weekend, but it's Halo Reach. And I just wanted to bring it up briefly because it's really my first time playing Halo for any length of time. I had played, I think, the original Halo on Xbox. I played the campaign for like 15 minutes once, and I had played a little bit of like local multiplayer a couple of times and didn't like it. I felt it was kind of too slow and the grenades were confusing, and I don't know, I couldn't get into it really. And then I didn't play any Halo 2 or Halo 3, didn't touch them, have never touched them before at all. So Halo Reach, I mean, one reason I wanted to get it was because it looked nice and colorful. It looked a lot better than Halo 3. And as I was hearing about some of the gameplay tweaks they'd made, they added the jetpacks and the running, and a lot of the things about it seemed to be a little more to my interest than the previous games. So I just decided to rent it, and I had a good time with it. I don't think it's like the best first-person shooter I've ever played, but I did enjoy it quite a bit, and I was very satisfied with the campaign mode. The level designs are kind of neat because they do tend to be fairly open, and they make you feel like you're really in this world, you know, and you can kind of explore it a little bit. You don't always have to go straight to the objective. You might not even know exactly where that is.
Yeah.
So it's not an open world game, but it has a little bit of that explorative feel, more than you would expect in a first person shooter.
Yeah, you're not herded down a corridor.
No, it's very different from Call of Duty.
You're
in
not
that
Call
respect.
Of Duty. Yes.
Yep.
And the graphics are very, very nice for sure. The story is kind of dumb. I just didn't really.
It always is.
I didn't find the story to be all that well done, but
yeah, the thing is, Halo Reach is not as bro-y as the other ones, though.
Yeah, I don't know if I mean I haven't played the other ones, but I think Halo Reach is plenty bro-y.
Can you define that term for our listeners, John?
For bro-y, I would define like it's big burly guys shooting things, killing things, saying the word fuck a lot for
like
no reason other than just trying to be badass. It's just there's a lot of, like, faux badassery in bro-y games.
Yeah. I think Halo Reach is, because the story is set around the squad that you're in, this unit of soldiers, and you see them during the missions. You know, they help out. They actually shoot guys sometimes. Mm-hmm. And you follow them. A lot of times, the way I knew where to go was to follow them, except sometimes they'd say, six, you take point. And I'm like, I don't know if you want me leading when I have no idea where I'm going.
Yeah.
But, you know, during the cutscenes, there's a lot of talking because you have these multiple characters who are traveling through the events together, and it's not as raunchy as Gears of War, but the story is very similar, really.
Yeah.
These guys are fighting an invasion, and they're, you know, they're building up their camaraderie together, and then a guy dies, and it's supposed to be tragic, but it's really just kind of
funny.
Yeah, see, I don't like that kind of stuff. I don't mind because it's pretty much typical for the genre, but I mean, Greg can back me up on this, like Killzone 2. Good lord. It's like, did he have to say fuck five times in that cutscene? Really?
I don't know what I want to call Killzone 2.
Reach is probably relatively classy.
Stay classy first-person shooters.
Anyway, I did enjoy the campaign quite a bit. There are a number of interesting combat scenarios you get into. A lot of them involve using like one-time weapons, like a turret. There's a pretty cool space battle chapter that feels a lot like Rogue Squadron. Really doesn't feel very different from Rogue Squadron at all, which is impressive considering that was 9 years ago.
Yeah.
Rogue Leader when you're up in space. But it reminded me quite a bit of that. It's pretty simple. It's certainly not as complex as TIE Fighter or something like that, or Free Space.
Yeah, that's one thing I liked versus other Halo games. They really did make an effort to break it up a bit. Like, it's not just a corridor march after corridor march. Like, the first Halo, it's probably why I didn't like it. It was just like, you are literally in corridors going around the Halo thing out in space, and then at the end of the game, or like halfway through, you turn around and you walk back down the corridor the other way. And that is literally Halo.
Oh, wow. It's like Super Ghouls and Ghosts in reverse.
Yep.
Yeah.
It is.
Well, the thing about Halo is, other than that starship, which I enjoyed quite a bit, I wish there was more of that, because I thought it was pretty clear they'd put a lot of effort into it, and it was fun, and I wish, you know, they'd given me a little more to do with it and give me a few more options. Mm-hmm. All the other vehicles feel terrible.
Yeah.
The controls are so shitty for all the tanks and the trucks and the jeeps and the motorcycles you can get into. In fact, the funny thing is, because you have these AI squad members during the campaign.
Oh, and they're awful at driving. Holy shit.
Yeah, that's
shit.
The funny thing. It's like, the first time I got to like one of these Jeep vehicles, because the levels are so big, you really want to get a vehicle, because otherwise you're going to be walking for 10 minutes to get to the next thing. So you want to get a vehicle, although it's technically optional. So the first time I got to one, I'm like, okay, I'm driving. I get in this thing, and I'm like running into walls. I'm like, what the hell is up with the controls on this thing? So the next time I found one, I'm like, I wonder if I can just get on the turret in the back and let the computer drive it. And sure enough, you can, but the computer was just as bad at me at driving.
Oh, God.
I mean, running, going backwards and all, way off the road and like oversteering on turns, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I've had the computer actually sit there and drive around in a circle and then
yes,
like hit a rock or something, roll the vehicle and kill me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like, it was
totally
unbelievable.
Possible.
I was like, wow, that just actually happened.
John, first off, you shouldn't be drinking before you go out on missions.
That's true. The AI has to.
Don't give the computer anything,
Johnny,
to drink.
Johnny, maybe the controls are actually perfect and the AI is showing you how bad the vehicles themselves are. Flawless controls.
It just seems
ever.
To something they just, I mean, all of the vehicles have always controlled like that and I've never understood it. It's just something.
It's terrible.
It's just something that they want to do with the series.
It's weird because the game controls really well when you're running around shooting things, but.
Yep.
It's just when you get in a vehicle, it's like, oh my God, I just walked into, it feels like Bioharvest.
Yeah. It's unbelievable.
Body Harvest. Body Harvest on N64. It actually feels a lot like the controls in Body Harvest, a game that is 12 years old.
And was not highly regarded for its vehicles.
I like Body Harvest, but the vehicle controls are shitty. I mean, well, let me put it this way. Those guys went on to make GTA 3. And, yeah. So, the vehicle controls are really not that studio's strong point. And apparently not Bungie's either. So,
yeah.
Anyway, the combat I generally found to be a lot of fun, very satisfying. The only thing I had a problem with is that there's no grenade indicator. And maybe I'm spoiled by Call of Duty, but I got killed so many times by grenades that I never saw or heard.
Yep.
It's just, you're fighting and then you're dead.
Totally agree.
In the campaign, that's not supposed to happen. And it's because some guy threw a grenade at you. And I'm like, you know, if I'd known it was there, if I could have even heard it, I would have run away. But I had no idea there was a grenade at my feet because you don't have any peripheral
vision.
There's
so much going on around you. Like, just sound-wise, there's explosions, there's all kinds of crazy shit happening coming from all directions. So a lot of times you'll actually hear somebody throw a grenade or you'll hear a grenade land, but you won't have any idea where the hell it is.
Well, because your bros are too busy to tell you there's a grenade.
That's true. They're too busy high-fiving themselves and patting themselves on the butt.
I enjoyed Halo. I'm glad I got to try it. I don't know if I'll ever play another Halo game, but it was just kind of something I'd been meaning to do for a while, and you know, Gamefly is good for that kind of thing. It's like, I don't know if I'm gonna like this game. I'm gonna be adventurous and give it a shot at least.
Yeah, I mean, I like, my take on it is like, you know, if you're not a first person shooter fan but you kind of have a hankering for one, play through it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's fun. There's a lot of cool set pieces in there.
Yeah, I did get Fling Smash yesterday.
Oh,
and
no.
I played just the first world of it, and I actually am having a good time with it so far. I don't know if it gets worse and worse as you go or if it's just too thin to last the whole game, but it seems reasonably fun. It's nothing special, but I did notice that it's made by Artoon.
Yes.
And for a company with art in the name, they sure can come up with some ugly characters.
Oh, that game is
holy crap. It is really ugly. Just not graphically, artistically, it's really ugly. It's just bad art. But actually, I wanted to ask James, I don't know if you've heard about this, but you recently said that if you only had to pick one Japanese RPG for Wii to come to the US, you'd pick Last Story over Xenoblade.
Yes.
Would you maintain that choice with the recent revelation that Artoon, or AQ Interactive as they're now called, are the secret developer behind The Last Story?
Artoon has been the secret developer behind a bunch of games in the past. But
most of them not good.
Yeah.
Like Yoshi's Island DS and...
I trust the development team, and generally speaking, the impressions from that game tend to have been fairly positive, but the character designs are god-awful.
Hmm.
I mean, I've seen
consistent.
I doubt that. I think they're not even working on that, though. I think they're on the programming side.
No, they're not. But I've seen some high-res concept art of these characters, and they are god-awful.
Well, you know, Nintendo usually sends out a big release list in... like the very last week of December after Christmas or the first week of January. So if one of these RPGs doesn't show up on that list, I'm beginning to lose hope that either one
is going
to show
up. Well, at least in that one, the Last Story still won't have been out yet, I don't
think.
Yeah,
it's not coming out in Japan until January. So
yeah.
It's true, but yeah. I mean, with a game like that, you would hope that...
they've made up their mind already.
Yeah, rather than just leave everybody hanging.
It's got some shadiness around it, but God... why did it have to be Artoon? Because right now, and I'm not kidding, in some regions you can get Fling Smash with the Wii Remote Plus for less than the Wii Remote Plus.
That's what I did. That's why I bought it.
Nice.
It's not because I wanted Fling Smash. It's because I wanted a Remote Plus for $32.
It's awful. That's just terrible.
I like the Remote Plus, actually. It feels good. It feels slight. I don't know. This might be in my imagination. It feels maybe slightly heavier than the original Wii Remote, which is good. And then the jacket for it, it's been a while since I looked at a remote jacket because I just stopped using them after a while.
Yeah, I never used them.
Whoosh. And so I actually pulled out one of the old clear ones that they mailed me, you know, separately and compared it. And the black one, I mean, I wanted a black controller too because I didn't have one and it looks really nice. But the black one has a solid black jacket as well. So it's not clear like the other one. And I think it actually looks a lot nicer this way. But I played some Donkey Kong with it. I played some Fling Smash with it. I like that controller too. That's going to wrap up New Business. Thanks for sticking with us. We're going to take a break and come back with your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
All right, on the review front, we have a review of James Bond Bloodstone for DS by Neil. He takes a super spy out for a portable spin and tells you why this is a solid entry in the grand pantheon of Bond games. We also have another review of Sonic Colors for DS by Neil again, and he weighs in on this 2D platformer and tells us whether or not Sonic fans will be victimized by the infamous Sonic cycle.
Neil has been pumping out reviews, and he's got even more coming.
Yep, yeah, he's a review machine. We also have a blog by our own James Jones called Evil is Live Backwards. And it says here, I don't know who wrote this, but it says that James gets the latest hot album off of iTunes and posts a video for the hardcore hip-hoppers. I don't know what that means, but you might want to check it out.
You might want to check that out.
You might want to.
Grant Buell reviewed Flip's Twisted World this week. If you followed our developer diaries for this game, you might be interested to see our coverage wrap up on it. And how did the final product end up? Read Grant's review to find out. And another review this week is James' aforementioned Golden Sun Dark Dawn review, where he looks at the successes of the GBA Golden Sun games and finds out that it is indeed still a lot like those games.
More reviews! We've got Pac-Man Party from Pedro. It's a Pac-Man party game. It's a party game with Pac-Man. It sounds like a great idea, but Pedro tells us if this one is equivalent of eating a power pellet, or if it will give its players a back attack.
Buzzing!
Or if it will fill you up with a baby Pac-Man.
Calm down, man. You're going to have a back attack.
There's no words there.
They really should. Those do not qualify as words.
To play us out? Okay. We also got a review of Bit Trip Fate from Neil Ronahan. Man, he's churning them out.
The Neil-inator.
Bit Trip series, of course, is uncompromisingly difficult. Neil finds Fate to be no different. Is it challenging or intolerable? Find out when you read his review. And finally, we have some excellent, very, very extensive impressions of Fluidity from Aaron Kaluska, who got to go check it out with Nintendo out there in San Francisco. And this is the new WiiWare puzzle game, and of course, he walked away very impressed. See what his first take is and learn a lot about the mechanics. There are also quite a few very good videos in that article that you can check out. We are back for part two of Radio Free Nintendo 2-2-2-2-2-2-2-2.
All the two.
It's time for listener mail. The address to send in your comments and questions and ideas is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And James has the first question.
Dan from State College, Pennsylvania writes, I'm finishing up grad school, and while I'm completing my thesis, I've been doing my best to hold off playing video games, which I've broken a few times to sneak in some StarCraft 2 practice and some WorldCraft 3 campaigns that I never got around to playing back before the widescreen resolutions were around. However, in this process, I found myself gathering a collection of untouched games as unpassable deals have come and gone and I've had to spring on them. First, it was only Final Fantasy XIII, then Epic Yarn, then Fable 3, and now Red Dead Redemption is on the way to my door. I'm starting to fear this slippery slope, and I wanted to ask if you guys had tips on how to not... to not fall into a Lindemann-esque behavior so as I actually get around to playing these games. I've already unwrapped the plastic and looked through the manuals a little, so I feel like I've at least started the process of folding them into my game's rotation, although I think this might be one of the first symptoms. Well, to be fair, if you've opened them, you've already passed John.
The title of this email was Lindemann Syndrome.
Yes, Lindemann Syndrome. It's always an achievement when somebody names a syndrome after you.
You've made it, John.
So I must thank you, Dan.
Looks like you made it through the rain.
Don't attempt to give him any advice on this, because you're the terrible end to that slippery slope.
So he's asking me to pretty much say that, you know, I'm a cautionary tale in the making, really, is what
he's... Yeah, you're the after-school special, yes.
Yeah. How to not turn out like I did.
So, for the sake of being totally upfront, I do have games that I need to play. Oh, but it's not that I'm not playing games.
Everybody has a Lindy here and a Lindy there. You know what I mean?
I got Lindy's into every area code.
No. I hope not.
You got a couple. I know there's a couple on your shelf. There's a couple of Lindy's on your shelf.
Actually,
buddy.
They're not on my shelf. They're in a specific pile for games that are in the queue to be played.
Of course they are, James.
Because I can't get the cube so high because it'll fall off the desk.
Mm-hmm.
Keeps me working on them.
See, I don't think I'm a good person to answer this either because I played games way too much throughout the process of writing my thesis. So I never really dealt with this. I just slept less and less.
Right. Well, I mean, that's kind of my approach to work. So it's fine.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there are times when there are deals where you should snap up the game even if you don't have time to play it now. I mean, that's why I have a bunch of these games sitting up there. You know, GameStop, they're three for the price of two deals.
Yeah. Or,
and at that point, you're like, well, I'm going to play this game eventually, so I might as well just get it now. Or it's two of the games I wanted, but they're still a little bit above my price. But with this third game in there, it averages out where I'm okay with this deal. So, yeah, I mean, I've still got No More Heroes 2 sitting around to play, but it's not because I don't plan on playing it. It's because other stuff was either in the queue and ahead of it, or has jumped it because it had a higher priority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the only game that I own right now that I haven't played yet is Boomblock's Bash Party.
You just bought it for the cover art.
No, it's because there was an Amazon deal where I essentially got it for free from buying World Ends With You and something else.
Mm.
Because last year, I traded in the original Boomblocks when Bash Party came out with the intention of getting Bash Party to replace it.
Mm.
And then I never got around to doing that. And so, because I like Boomblocks, and I want to have a Boomblocks game around for when I feel like playing it with people. Mm-hmm. So I finally just filled in that little slot in my library, and I'm sure I'll play it.
Yeah, I've got three right now. So like I said, No More Heroes 2, I've got Touch Detective, which I got for like $5, which is pretty much like stealing it, essentially. And then I have the other half of the double pack from Nuts and Bolts and Viva Pinata.
Yeah.
But at its height, the stack was like 7. So I am getting through it.
Yeah, so I mean, for you, you accumulate a bunch of things if there happens to be a whole bunch of deals at once,
yeah.
And then you ultimately work through it. Where you might want to reconsider your purchasing policy is if that pile just grows indefinitely.
And it did for a little bit.
Then you might want to have a little spending review and say, actually, there really isn't much point in me snatching up these. As good as these deals might look in an absolute sense, there really isn't all that much point if the rate at which you buy games is such that pile just gets bigger and bigger.
Are you really talking to James now, Greg?
No.
Or are you just using him as a proxy?
I'm speaking to the person that actually wants help, John, rather than the person that's given up and is just wantonly spending things that they'll never get
this
any enjoyment
true.
Out of.
I'll see you at the poorhouse, Leahy, and damn it, I'll have a flat screen.
So John, let me explain something to you. If you're an engineer, then when you're in college, you take a class called differential equations.
Oh.
And the classic example that they use is there's a tank with a spout of water going in and a spout draining out. Okay?
Yes.
And you've heard this, James.
Oh, yes.
And so you could use differential equations to determine how long it will take the tank to fill up and overflow if the amount of water going into it is somewhat greater than the amount coming out of it. And I feel like this applies to John Lindemann very appropriately.
Yeah, John's been knee-deep for years now.
By the way, that is literally the only thing I remember from differential equations.
Oh, I remember suffering. That's what I remember from differential equations.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it could be the other way around, though. It could be money going in and the hole coming out where John buys cat helmets.
You know, if his money vat overflows, I don't think he'll be complaining.
It's the cat helmet vat that's overflowing.
No, I mean, realistically, this is a real problem people have. And, you know, if you like to buy games as much as you like to play them, or if you like to collect games to some degree, then it can get to a point where your life situation changes, even temporarily, maybe permanently, and it can start to feel, not a panic, but you start to feel guilty about, you know, the games that are just kind of piling up, and then you see a new one and you want to buy that because there's a good deal on this new game. But you really shouldn't buy it because you got all these other games you haven't played yet. And now you feel like, should I spend the money on it or not? Am I ever going to play it? Am I ever going to play all that other stuff? Am I just making the problem worse? So, I mean, it's not a serious problem. Having too many games is not going to kill anybody. But
yeah,
it can make you feel bad, and it can disrupt how much you enjoy playing your video game, which is the reason that you should be buying them in the first place. So I would recommend, as a serious measure, because I have gotten into this occasionally and dug myself out of it like James is talking about, I would say look at the games that you are actually playing right now. Maybe there's stuff like Warcraft 3 that's not exactly brand new. And ask yourself, would you rather be playing that or one of these games that you haven't touched yet?
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't feel like playing some of this other stuff. When you do have time to play games, think about what you actually want to play. Don't necessarily go for the easiest thing just because, well, I don't have to learn it, or I don't have to worry about, you know, going through the tutorials or the early parts of it. I can just go into this thing that's familiar and just have a good time. And certainly, I mean, if that's what you want to do, then do that. But if you really want to try this other game, then you might need to sacrifice playing an older game that you just play for a long time. And I think, John, I don't want to accuse you, but I think this might be the case with you with some of your MMOs that you've been playing for a long time.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying you shouldn't play those,
but
those are part of the reason that you have all these disc games piling up, because you're not willing to give up some of the time that you spend. So it's just, these are the choices that you're making. If you can be honest about them, then you won't feel as guilty.
What is this, an intervention?
If indeed you find that playtime is indispensable, then you might want to reconsider your purchasing policy at that point.
I mean, if the MMOs are more important to you, then play those and stop spending money on other games that you're not going to play. If you're playing the MMO because you feel guilty that you're paying a monthly fee and that you should play it to make your money's worth, then you might want to reconsider that
decision.
Cancel
your account.
I'm just saying, be honest about what you want to be doing with your time and your money, and just follow through with that rather than do things because you feel like you're supposed to or something like that.
Well, see, for me, it was a blessing that we did The World Ends With You, because there was a good chance I was never going to touch that game.
Even though you already had it. Yeah.
Because I knew it was a bear to get your hands around, or get your head around, rather. And I had all these other games. I was like, well, I could just stick with these. But it was sitting there taunting me next to my
keyboard. It's kind of like reading Moby Dick. Like, at some point, you kind of have to say, I'm going to fucking read Moby Dick, and I'm going to do it. It's like starting a diet or a workout plan, or, you know.
Yeah,
like,
but it's
And in the end, you'll probably be glad you did. But it's not the easiest thing to start, because it's intimidating.
It's an investment.
That happens, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly types of games that I avoid now where I wouldn't have in the past, like... I haven't touched Fallout New Vegas, any of those kind of games where they're single player, you can put hundreds of hours into them.
Yeah.
Any of those things, I just, I look at them and I'm like, wow, that looks cool, and I bet that's a really good game, but realistically, I would never play it.
Fallout New Vegas, don't worry, you couldn't play it anyway, it'd just crash on you.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing, and I mean, realistically, it's like, there's games that are probably 15 hours long that I don't play through.
Mm-hmm.
See, I got into this a little bit recently where I would pull out old games and play them because I hadn't played them in a while. And I was like, I've got Touch Detective to play. I should go play that. And I'm like, do I really want to learn Touch Detective?
I do find that as I'm getting older, I don't think it has to do with my age. I think it has to do with my knowledge of what's out there, what's available, and what I might find interesting. I'm starting to play a larger number of games, and the podcast has affected that too.
Yes, yeah.
But I'm starting to play a larger variety and just a larger quantity of games, so I'm spending less time with each one individually.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm starting to become attracted. When I buy a game for my own pleasure, a game that I just really want to play, I'm starting to choose games that are shorter and easier to get into. And a lot of it's the download stuff, whether it's on WiiWare or Live Arcade and stuff like that, or even Steam. I'm starting to put more money into those, and I'm not looking for simpler or more casual games. I'm looking for, a lot of times, the same kinds of games that I've always liked to play, just shorter, just so I can feel like I get some closure there and I can move on. I mean, like something like Costume Quest was great because it's like a 6-hour RPG. Mm-hmm. It's really fun. It plays just like Mario RPG from my childhood. It's not an overly simple game. It's just short.
Yeah.
And then they released this DLC this week, and it adds like another 2 hours onto it for $5. Perfect. That's just what I want.
That's why I like stuff like Super Meat Boy. I mean,
hell yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You can play that in chunks. You know, you can play a couple of levels and
chunks of meat.
I don't know, John. You don't have to defend yourself. You know, I mean, just.
I disagree. John, defend yourself.
No, you don't. When it comes down to it, my philosophy, and I've said this before, play the games you want to play. Just be honest with yourself about what those games are. You know,
well, I mean,
sometimes it's worth taking a step back and actually examining what's in front of me, what's on my plate. I can't eat it all. What am I going to choose? What do I really want? And just be cool with that. You know.
In my defense, did I not go for a long stretch without even buying any new games to the point where I didn't even have anything to talk about on the podcast anymore?
I know. Sometimes, John, you do buy stuff and we don't hear about it for ages. And then it's like, oh, that's sitting on my shelf. You know, we don't know. We haven't got real-time stats of your bank account.
Well, the problem I have is with, you know, things like Black Friday, where, you know, there is a game, like, for example, like, you know, I was not going to pass up Sin and Punishment 2 when I can get it for $16. I wanted that game. If I would have had the money, I would have probably bought it at launch. But for $16, of course, and that type of game, I don't need to put tons of hours into it because it's
no,
a shoot 'em up.
No, it's short. You'll have a good time with it.
That, I'm not going to pass that up.
It is intimidating, but not for that reason.
Yeah.
So next week, John will tell us all about Sin and Punishment 2.
No, he won't.
I'll get to it. Actually, I wanted to play it, but I got wife overruled for that television. She rules that television, so I couldn't.
It's got co-op, John.
It's a good introduction for suffering, mostly. But it's a good introduction. It'll be good to go.
Greg, you have the next letter.
Indeed I do. This is from Mr. Leroy Pantweather, a pseudonym if ever there was one.
I disagree.
He has weather in his pants. It's
look, there's a well-established Pantweather clan. I don't know what you're talking about.
If a bellwether is, you know, an indicator, what's a Pantweather?
It's another kind of indicator.
Hey guys, me again. Just wanted to say great job on the live show. It motivated me to donate, and assuredly was a treat for anyone who got a chance to listen.
Thank you.
Indeed. Before my current job, I worked at a major video game retailer. Over the years working there, I sold countless copies of M-rated games to children of all ages, with complacent parental permission, of course. Obviously, this is not as prevalent on the Nintendo platforms as on the other systems, but with titles such as Grand Theft Auto DS, Mad World, No More Heroes, etc., etc., the issue in question still exists. How do you guys feel about kids and mature games?
I don't have that much personal experience with it because I don't have kids. And when I was a kid, we didn't really have M-rated games. I mean, the M-rating didn't exist until I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And before then, most games were censored if they would have had any objectionable stuff anyways.
Yeah, or games like that would have been on the PC, right?
Yeah, and yeah. I didn't play stuff like that. So I played Mortal Kombat on Super Nintendo.
With the gray blood, yes.
Yep.
I played violent games on the PC when I was growing up. So like the old first-person shooters that were barely 3D.
Mm-hmm. Like Wolfenstein?
Yeah, 2D models moving in a 3D space, basically. Yeah, and they were, at the time, they were really gory shit.
Yeah, that's kind of when mature games really started to come out. It's like with Doom.
I mean, they were the most juvenile games for ostensibly adults ever. Like you had the game, what was it called, Shadow Warrior? The one where it was Duke Nukem with an Asian guy?
Yes.
Where the height of writing was things like fortune cookies about shitting in the toilet. I mean, it was terrible.
But yeah, do you remember Blood or Blood 2?
Vaguely.
Those were very popular among my group of friends, and we used to go. This is funny. We in my little crappy hometown in Alabama, we had a LAN center like the ones in Korea, and mm-hmm. and this you see this very rarely in the U.S. At least now, maybe in the 90s it was a bigger deal because see, back in the 90s we didn't have internet at home. So you could go to this place and give them like $5 and get on the internet for an hour. And they also had all these games. So we played Total Annihilation and Blood 2 and Duke Nukem and stuff like that on a LAN together. And the weird thing is this place also had a climbing wall.
Yes.
Okay. So it was a LAN center and a climbing wall. But, you know, they didn't have any kind of parental permission form or anything. It was just, you know, pay your money, you can play any game that's on the system. Yeah. And, I don't know. I just never thought anything of it.
See, I mean, I wasn't really conditioned to think anything of it. I mean,
yeah.
Shadow Warrior is a great example because, I mean, the main character's name is Lo Wang.
Why are we laughing at that?
That's because it's so awful.
So funny, that's why.
He occasionally belches out quotes like, "Man who stand on toilet high on pot."
I'm like 2 years old right now.
it's awful.
Well, the thing is, though, things have really changed, though, like since Columbine and all that kind of stuff, where people were looking for like something that caused it. Oh, it must be Doom, where there's so much blood and gore, you know, stuff like that. I mean, that kind of stuff has definitely changed the way people perceive, you know, mature games.
I think you see a lot less implication nowadays that, you know, when something goes wrong, everybody starts looking at, well, what was he playing on his computer at home?
Yeah.
That was a bad era in the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s, that you heard that a lot.
Yep.
And now I think that has passed. And part of the reason I think that it's passed is that a lot of the stigma around video games in general has gone away because everybody plays video games now.
Yeah,
whether it's on your iPhone or Farmville or Sims or whatever, everybody, my sister and her brother-in-law are asking me for video games for Christmas. I mean, it's to that point. They have a baby. So everybody's playing video games now. And so it's not like that big bad thing that you go look to see. You know, were they playing Dungeons and Dragons in the sewers, you know, and all that shit that you used to hear about.
Yep.
So I think that's mostly gone away. But one thing we've glossed over it so far, I think, is, you know, we talked about some of the M-rated games from when we were kids, but the M-rated games that come out now are a lot more aggressive and realistic and violent than what we grew up with. I mean, Duke Nukem is really kind of a comedy game. It's
dopey,
grotesque, but
yeah,
you know, some of the stuff that comes out now, I mean, in Gears of War, you can curb stomp a guy like in American History X, and you can saw a guy's head off with your chainsaw in multiplayer. And I'm not saying that's evil, but that is in a different class than the stuff that we grew up with. So, you know, that stuff doesn't bother me now, but it might bother me if I was 5 years old and I played it. So, I don't know. I feel like, in general, kids have a visceral reaction to stuff like that. So if you're a kid and you're prone to be disturbed by something like that, then you will be, and you probably won't want to play it.
Yeah, and I mean, you really don't have a context for it. And
if you think it's really cool, then you've probably seen it before.
Yeah, it's just like a lot of the movies where you'll watch them when you're like 6 years old and you'll think it's absolutely amazing. And then you'll watch it as an adult and you'll be like, wow, this is absolute garbage. Because the things that you appreciate about the movie as an adult are entirely different and entirely above and beyond what you see as a kid.
Yeah. So I have two kind of stories here. Well, I'll go to John's first point now because it's pertinent. I actually had a friend, and her favorite movie growing up was this 80s movie called Solar Babies.
Oh, God, it sounds terrible.
I mean, it's moronic, but we watched it recently, and she was ashamed of herself because it's so amazingly terrible. Although, to be honest, it's kind of funny how bad it is. So if you have access to Hulu because you live in a region where you can, you should probably pull it up because it's really bad.
Yeah, I recently saw The Giver, which is a movie that I kind of liked when I was like 12 years old.
Oh my god.
And holy shit, it is literally Power Rangers for adults. So, just to give you the capsule review.
It stinks. It stinks.
It involves Jimmy, what's his name from Dynamite?
Oh god, JJ Walker.
Jimmy Walker. Oh my god.
JJ Walker, yes. Jimmy Walker is one of the villains in this movie. He spends about half the movie dressed in a full body rubber suit doing kung fu while making racist jokes. I mean, holy shit. The best actor in the movie by leaps and bounds is Mark Hamill, a man known for being a bad actor.
Beautiful.
What are you trying to say about Corvette?
The Giver is messed up. Don't watch it. Seriously.
It is so bad. Watch it because
it's
terrible.
So bad.
But
oh man.
But my second story relates to young children and violence. So I've got two nieces. They're roughly the same age. One's 5, one's 4.5. And one of them's mother is like super overprotective and like, you know, everything has to be clean, must clean everything. And when I'm dealing with her, she's incredibly easy to grief about these kinds of things. So her daughter is super obsessive, and any kind of violence freaks her out. Her cousin has his father, who's a meathead, basically. You know, loves his hunting and killing. She once came up to me and asked if I wanted to play a game of hunting where she would be the deer. Only she was already dead and it was just gutting on the table because that's what she had watched her and her grandfather do.
It's kind of weird, dude.
No, it was alarming because she sprawled out on a coffee table. It was very alarming. But this kid, her context of violence is so well established that she might not react to this kind of stuff, but her cousin who...
She's not really disturbed by it.
Right, but her cousin would be mortified by it.
Yeah.
Which really makes me think neither of them should have exposure to this kind of material.
I mean, sure. In the end, yeah, you have to leave it in the control of the parents, obviously. Parents will know their children best in terms of whether this is the kind of thing that's going to affect them.
Right.
And that's really the main function of rating systems, as I see it, is to spell out very clearly and concisely for parents what it is in the game that could affect their kids, or, you know, what themes, you know, be it sexual or violent or anything else.
Or just saying fuck every five words.
So that they can make a kind of informed decision on behalf of their kids. And obviously that's part of the responsibility of being a parent, is actually, you know, taking the time to actually make an informed decision in that area. And so I'm sure there are cases, kind of as is implied by Leroy's letter, where the parents have given the kids kind of carte blanche to get whatever the hell they want, and they probably shouldn't have done. And then, you know, the retailers are kind of just happily going along with this by selling these games in these situations where they could kind of guess that it would be inappropriate to give them to the kids. But that, to me, is the parents' responsibility.
They have no policy. If the parent's there, they have to sell the game.
I mean, there's probably grey areas where, you know, maybe retailers are a bit more aggressive or active in this kind of thing, maybe with some of the more unscrupulous ones, that perhaps you could cast aspersions on them in those circumstances. But in the most part, you know, it's probably due to a deficit in attention from parents, if it happens at all, because perhaps they're just very busy, or perhaps they're not, you know, aware. This goes to Johnny's previous point about games being more mainstream now, but, you know, perhaps in the old days, in the fledgling days, parents might have had a sort of blanket assumption that all games were appropriate for children.
Right.
Which would be unfounded, but...
Beat 'em and eat 'em.
In the NES era, you could probably imagine a lot of parents felt that way. They're like cartoons, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the vast majority of them were. So, you know, you could kind of see how that would happen. But today, that's very much less sort of tenable position, if you like, because there's so much more information out there. And, you know, adult games themselves are very mainstream. Like, you know, I mean, Call of Duty is racking up, you know, historic entertainment launch numbers. You know, it is a video game, it is not for children. So
yeah, but I guarantee that at least 25%, if not 50% of the people who bought Call of Duty or who are playing it are under 18.
Yeah, I'm always surprised at the kids I hear online.
If that's the case of parents have, you know, looked at it and said, you know, I know what's in the game broadly and I'm okay with that, well, that's their decision, that's their children. That's not really for anyone else to say that they're wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually seen
parents... I disagree
parents...
there, but there's nothing we can do about it. So.
That's the thing. I mean, I've actually seen parents playing online, like fathers playing online with their son kind of thing. And I don't know how I feel about that. You know, it's and you know their kid's like maybe 12 or 13 years old and they're sitting there playing with them. And I'm like,
that's cool though. I mean, you know, cool, I saw my dad kill animals when I was a kid. It didn't, you know, it didn't scar me or anything. It's okay when you have someone there.
Yeah.
I feel like, I mean, if the case study that we're looking at, if the hypothetical situation is that a parent is present when a very mature, maybe disturbing or very violent game is purchased for a child, then there's probably two different scenarios that play out there. Number one, maybe the parent knows full well what's in the game, has talked to the kid about it, is okay with it, and in that case, I don't care because I assume that the parent knows the child well enough and has thought through this well enough to feel confident that the child isn't going to be harmed by this.
Yep.
It's a well-reasoned decision that they've made to buy this game for their kid. Okay. In the other case, the parent doesn't care, doesn't know anything about it, hasn't talked to the kid about it, and is just doing whatever the kid wants. In that case, I feel like the parent's probably so negligent in general that playing a violent video game is not really my chief concern for that child's welfare.
No, but that is the more troubling scenario, obviously.
Sure.
Well, yeah.
But in that case, I don't think playing a video game is going to make that kid's life any worse.
No.
It's probably a form of escape for that kid.
Well, I mean, the third option there is just that the parents are ignorant. Not in general, but in this specific area.
Well, I think parents use game consoles to just sit their kids, you know?
Yeah. Well, so what I've witnessed in the past, and it depends on the staffer, but I've seen a lot of times where it's pretty apparent that a parent is buying an M-rated game for a kid where the staff goes, just so you know.
Oh, yeah.
But they're almost always brushed off. I think I've only seen one time where the parent seemed a little concerned about it, and that was some bullshit like Gears of War, and I was like, ugh.
Yeah, where it's like so violent that...
I think he actually described intimately something that happens in the game, and the parent was like, ugh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I think some parents just really don't understand what kind of stuff goes on in these games and how realistic they are.
I think it's not because they're negligent parents, it's just because they just don't get it.
Well, there's a lot more good information out there now. Some of it's on whattheyplay.com or Wikipedia even. Some of it's on the box itself. So if the parent actually cares, I would much rather have the information available than for it to be like when I was a kid where there were games I wasn't allowed to play because of a rumor about it. Like, I remember being told that my sister and I couldn't rent the game Stinger for NES because you could bomb churches in it. I think it's like a side-scrolling shoot 'em up, and you can drop bombs on the landscape, and there are like crosses or some building that looks kind of like a church. And I don't even know if that's true. I probably wouldn't have noticed it if I'd play the game, but my mom heard about it from some other mom, you know, and decided that we shouldn't rent that game. Now, do I feel like a missed opportunity? No, not really. But back then, that kind of stuff was based on hearsay. And now they actually have facts and legitimate vetted sources of information for this kind of thing. So it's better now.
You've got those ESRB descriptors that, you know, go into quite a bit of detail now.
Yeah.
That kind of summarize some of the more potentially contentious areas of
Well, and we have the internet now.
Yeah, you have no excuse. I mean, parents have no excuse now.
That kind of thing is what gave us the space blouse in Mass Effect 2, right?
Oh, yeah.
References the space blouse.
Well, I mean, that was one of the more ridiculous sensationalist coverage of I mean,
oh yeah,
I mean, to be honest, this is still a field that gets ridiculous sensationalism. And
shit, I wish there was more sex in video games and less violence.
Mm-hmm.
I think what Mass Effect 2 did was a step in the right direction. I think that was good for the industry and for the art form. I think it was done kind of clumsily, but the idea that we could potentially have video games that portray sex in a mature and realistic manner in which the characters are emotionally involved and know what they're doing and do it consensually, we're not there. But, I mean, that would be good if that is one of the tools in the tool set of these artists, rather than can we make this guy bleed twice as much,
yep.
Which I feel like is what goes into some games. I'm not making generalizations.
The Resident Evil 4 began the Chainsaw Blood Parade.
Yep.
Well, anyway, you know, this is a big topic. We've never quite talked about it in this way, so I think it's a great question, but we got to move on. So if anyone's listening and you have your thoughts, post them in TalkBack or on Facebook, or send us another email and follow up and let us know what you think. Maybe there's a piece of this topic that we didn't get to that you want to hear more about. So send us an email and we'll get to it later. So, John has the next letter.
All right, Spencer in Kansas writes, I just finished the last few episodes and heard about the live show on Saturday. So I just happened to be getting married that afternoon. I find pretty cool my favorite podcast will be live for hours upon hours, but at the same time I'm like, what the fuck, guys? I'm probably going to be on the sound system's computer trying to listen in. Now we share an anniversary, and you can help me celebrate by doing a yearly live show. I'm sure that you have more important video game-related conversations to get to, so have an awesome show.
Congratulations, and if you were listening to the live show on the sound system, I fear for your marriage.
Exactly.
That was the processional as she walked down the aisle, was John doing the DK rap.
Oh, I feel for your
live.
Sanity, man. Oh.
Live.
So my response to Spencer is, we will try, I'm not promising anything, but we will try to do another live show next year on your anniversary if you will promise to get married again every year.
That sounds expensive.
Yeah.
How about you just give us the money you would spend in the divorce and the marriage?
Well, no, that's very cool, Spencer. Thank you for writing in, and I hope you enjoyed the recording, which is up now. So you didn't miss it. You missed the live interaction, but you didn't miss the content.
You were doing something much better.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, the last letter for this week is from Ryan in Anaheim, California, and he writes, "The end of the year is approaching, and it will soon be time to review the RFN predictions for 2010. I'm assuming new predictions will be made for 2011, in which case I'd like to make one of my own. It has been quite some time since Dragon Quest X was announced as a Wii exclusive, and we haven't heard much about it since. I'm guessing that it will not be released for Wii. I believe it will be canceled for that platform and moved to 3DS, mainly due to the Wii's decreasing popularity and the strength of handheld systems in Japan. What do you think of my prediction, and what are your thoughts on Dragon Quest X?
I'm thinking I can't wait till we get to review our 2010 predictions.
You got Galaxy 2 wrong. What are you so proud of?
I went 2 for 3, though. That's pretty good.
What do you guys think about this idea of Dragon Quest X being moved to 3DS?
Well, we certainly haven't heard much from it.
We haven't, but that's not terribly unusual for a Dragon Quest game.
The weird thing was they announced it so early. I mean, it clearly wasn't coming out anytime soon when they announced it.
Yeah.
I think it had some political sort of intentions by announcing it for Wii at the time. Well, basically, to pat down any kind of rumor that it might be going to PS3 or something like that.
I mean, a lot was at the press event. So, yeah. I mean, Nintendo money had it this.
Yeah, I'm sure Dragon Quest X was not in development at that time at all.
No, it assuredly wasn't.
And they always come out late in any console's life cycle anyways.
Absolutely. That's my primary counterpoint here is that even though the Wii seems to be, you say decreasing popularity, I mean, Wii hardware sales are slowing down, but the number of people who own Wiis is not really going down. It can't, really.
Yeah.
And that's primarily what Square Enix cares about. They've always released the new Dragon Quest on the most popular system at the time. And really, Dragon Quest IX was no change from that. So it would be a bit of a departure for DQ10 to come out on Wii just because the real money would be to release it on DS, not 3DS. They're not, I don't see them putting it on 3DS unless they delay it another 4 years. Not because it'll take that long to develop, but because they always release these games late in the system's life when they have the largest possible user base. Because in Japan, people are going to go out and buy this game. It doesn't matter if they haven't touched their Wii or their DS in 3 years. They're going to go out and buy this game and play a ton of it. And so they really want to wait until there's just a huge critical mass of people who already have the system.
Well,
for
and
it.
the other thing is if the 3DS is out, let's say they do decide to release 3DS and say, well, this game's going to have long legs. It's okay. There's a lot of competition on the 3DS that there just simply won't be on Wii. I mean, the 3DS launch lineup and the years and about the year coming after it is stacked.
With RPGs, look, for Dragon Quest in Japan, there's no such thing
as
competition.
I'm talking about outside of Japan, though.
Outside of Japan, they don't expect to sell that many anyway.
It's not the primary concern.
I don't think Europe and the US bear any influence on their decision about what to do with that Dragon Quest franchise.
Well, I mean, typically, what I expect them to do is, what they seem to typically do is use one of their Dragon Quest spin-off franchises to sort of like get their legs on whatever console or portable, like either Dragon Quest Monsters Joker or, you know, with the Wii, they did the Dragon Quest Swords. So I think we'll see something like that on the 3DS before we see any Dragon Quest title on it.
I mean, I think Dragon Quest XI will probably come to 3DS.
Yeah, I would expect that.
But I still think Dragon Quest X will be on the Wii, and I think it'll probably be announced pretty soon, actually. It probably for a summer release. They usually come out in the summer in Japan. So if you think about when in the Japanese industry, games are usually revealed in full like 2 to 3 months before they come out. So I'd say by March, I bet we'll have seen something about Dragon Quest X. Because yeah. I think they'll probably be shooting for like a June, July release. Mm-hmm. And God knows how long it'll take for it to come out in English.
2013.
But I do think it'll probably come out this year in Japan on the Wii. That's my early prediction for 2011. I wouldn't give up on it yet, you know.
If you go into 2012, that is, you know, beginning to, as many Wiis as there would be, and as many Wii owners as there would be in Japan to sell to at that point.
Yeah, you're kind of pulling like a Weekend at Bernie's 2 trick on trying to get that thing back up and running and get people to go out.
It could be a little bit sort of passed by that.
I mean, the Wii has at least one more good year in it, at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that, you know, if they waited until like 2012 to make their big Wii release, it's not that it wouldn't work, but I think the fear might be that they might sell fewer copies in 2012 than they would in 2011. Because by 2012, people might be less interested. They might be more bothered by the ancient graphics technology.
By that time, they might be busy playing 3DS RPGs.
People might have packed up their Wiis and just they're not playing them anymore. It's not connected to the TV anymore.
Yeah, as you said, it's Dragon Quest. It would do well on Wii.
Yes, but it might do less well if they
it's a business. They want to maximize within, you know, whatever constraints they're faced with. 2012, you know, there used to be probably summer 2012 it would have to be. That seems like that would not be optimal. But, I mean, that's without knowing the development constraints that surround it.
Well, one thing I would say, though, is that Square Enix probably has... I mean, they obviously got 3DS kits early. They would be one of the teams that Nintendo would give one to quickly, outside of their own people. So, they probably have teams building stuff for it already.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But not Dragon Quest X.
No, they're more likely to devote time to make what is essentially something that is well-suited to this rather unique system. Think kind of like, but hopefully not the quality of, like, the Bouncer, which was well-suited to what the PS2 could do. That you couldn't do before, it just wasn't a very good game.
Yeah.
Hopefully better than that, but they're probably busy trying to create something that has their stylistic cues, but uses the 3D technology well.
Like Rad Racer 3D.
No.
Which Rad Racer was already in 3D.
Yes, it was.
And there was a Rad Racer 2, so it could just be Rad Racer 3D.
That's awful.
Ta-dao.
That game is never being made.
Actually, it'll be Rad Racer 3D : Driver Emotion Type S.
The one scenario I could see is if there were some sort of misfortune or something to beset the development process such that, you know, if they had intended to get it out in 2011 and that just isn't going to happen with all the will in the world, it's going into 2012, whether the map makes them rethink. You know, this is basically what happened with Twilight Princess. You know, we ended up getting two versions of that.
Well, the Zelda series is so much more ambitious than Dragon Quest.
I know.
In terms of technology and design, it's...
And everything.
I'm just thinking from a business point of view, depending on how well the 3DS comes out of the gate, what kind of software is selling well on it and all that kind of stuff, whether, you know, if for some reason the can gets kicked down the road, that maybe then it could be a consideration. But I wouldn't have thought it'd be plan A.
It's not totally out of the question, but I mean, part of the reason Twilight Princess got moved was to give a big title for the Wii launch.
Yes, but if it had been ready sooner, maybe it never would have been considered for that role.
Right.
You know, one more thing about Dragon Quest X that's really interesting, though, is it will be Level 5's first Wii game, I'm pretty sure. I can't think of anything else they've made for Wii.
Did they make some of the that anime soccer game for Wii?
Oh, Inazuma 11?
They might have.
I don't know. They might have farmed that out, too, but I'm not sure. Certainly be their first RPG for Wii.
Yeah.
And that's a shame, because knowing how long Dragon Quest games take to make and how late they tend to come out, when this game was first announced, you know, and that they were doing Dragon Quest 9, they made 8 too, it would have been nice if they had, like, maybe put some of their teams to make quicker Wii games sooner, you know, to prepare and to learn about the platform, etc. But it, you know, they do such amazing things with graphics technology that I can't wait to see what they do on Wii. Because Dragon Quest 8 looks spectacular on PS2.
Yeah, actually, they do not have any Wii games out. There is an Inazuma game coming out for the Wii.
Oh, so maybe that'll be their first.
Yeah, because I thought it was just DS so far.
Yeah, that's their first Wii game.
Okay.
Well, the only other thing I can think of really is just that whether they'll look at all at some of these sales numbers for other RPGs. I know there are other RPGs. It's very different from the Dragon Quest brand, the power of that. But if there's any suggestion that just people have become so entrenched in playing their RPGs on handhelds and like stuff like The Last Story and Xenoblade aren't performing that well. And Monster Hunter did, you know, well at 1 million, but it wasn't as massive as it is on portables and all that. That perhaps those numbers could play a role in deciding what they do with it.
That's a really good point, Greg, because if you look at all the previous Dragon Quest games, they've always been released on systems that were already very successful in the RPG genre, except for maybe their very first Dragon Quest.
The Final Fantasy games would have already kind of paved the way.
Typically.
Right, except for on DS, but on DS there were clearly tons of good RPGs already that have been pretty successful. Yeah. So we would Dragon Quest X on Wii would be the first time, I think, that they've released a Dragon Quest game on a platform that's not really known for having a lot of good RPGs. And that could be a concern. I mean, you have a very good point there.
Although, I mean, it has gotten better in the last few years, especially
yeah,
in Japan.
I mean, Nintendo themselves seem to be cultivating a better roster.
Yeah, I mean, and to be fair, no other console has really stepped up and, you know, become the RPG console. It's just very spread out this generation.
Anyway, we'll see. I think either way, we'll hear more about Dragon Quest X pretty soon, because it has been a year and a half since 9 came out in Japan. So the fans in Japan, and the investors, more importantly, have to be wondering what's going on with it. So I think they're going to have to say something soon.
Isn't it 2 years now since it was released? It was the end of 2008, right, that they announced it originally?
Yes. Anyway, hopefully we'll hear more about it, but I still think it'll be on Wii. If not Wii, then DS, but not 3DS. Not 3DS. So, all right, guys, that's going to have to wrap up this show. The email address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Please keep sending those great questions. We really enjoy them. And thank you to everybody who wrote in this week. The retroactive is going to continue. We decided that we hadn't played enough of it with all the preparation for RFN Live and everything, Thanksgiving, yada yada, since the last time we talked about it. So we're pushing that ahead to a future episode. And so that'll give us more time to play it. It'll give you more time to play it. If you have been playing along, or if you've ever played The World Ends With You and you haven't yet posted in the forum thread, I really encourage you to do so, because if you post, it might make someone else get an idea about something they want to say, and they post, it creates a chain reaction, and we get a lot of really cool feedback and topics for discussion when we come back to it soon. So we're going to wrap that up before the end of the year, don't worry, and then we'll move on to the next retroactive in the new year. You can find us on the Nintendo World Report forums, of course, Facebook, and iTunes. We definitely appreciate you leaving a review and marking a star rating for our podcast. And of course, you can also check out our sister podcast. That would be Radio Trivia with Michael TYP Cole. The newest episode also includes Zach Miller and a lot of listener requests. I think 3 out of the 5 games are very interesting games requested by listeners. And also the NWR Newscast, where they are talking about a lot of these review games that are coming out towards the end of the year and covering some of the more interesting news topics to come out this time of year. So, with that, we bid thee adieu.
Later.
Bye-bye.
The rhythm is a bit in the worker.
God, that's awful.
I'm eating, by the way.
That's just terrible.
So anybody out there that wants to bitch and complain that we're podcasting while we're eating, you can eat something and it's called a dick.
Wow. Seriously? Seriously? What are you, 5?
Just don't eat while you're talking, John. It's a small amount of time.
You don't talk that much anyway.
I just gotta keep it real.
All right, guys. Let's do it. Ready?
Yep.
John?
Yeah, man. I'm good.
James?
Fucking awful.
James, you ready?